All right, welcome everybody. So we have now a repeat offender for conversations with Dr. Cowan and friends. There's only been a few repeat offenders, so-called. But Andy is now one, and I don't think I need to do much of an introduction for Andy Kaufman, since everybody knows who that is, and it's amazing what you've been doing. So let me just start. I don't know. I think you've seen this. Maybe I have to share my screen first. I only have two ridiculous things to share. The first is this quote by Florence Nightingale. Have you seen this?
I believe so.
There are no specific diseases, only specific disease conditions. All disease at some period or another in its course is more or less a reparative process, not necessarily accompanied with suffering, an effort of nature to remedy a process of poisoning or decay, which has taken place weeks, months, sometimes years beforehand unnoticed. I think that's about as good a summary as I've ever heard.
It completely fits with all of my experience working with people.
Yeah, there's something that's causing decay, or it's been poisoned. That's it. And that your body tries to do something about it, which is a reparative process. And that's where we get symptoms, everything from pus to tumors. It's all sort of different reparative processes. So today we're talking about turpentine, and I thought, because we've done another one on turpentine, but you've taken, I think, a much deeper dive into it, which is great, because I was thinking, I don't know if you would agree with this, Andy, but if there was one medicine, you know, it's the old, if you were stranded on a desert island and you could take one medicine, I think you'd have to put turpentine into the top three.
I definitely agree, because in any serious life-threatening condition, the chances of it helping are quite high, and there aren't too many substances that offer as much versatility in their application.
All right, Andy. So tell us, what is turpentine? Why should everybody know about it? What does it do? How does it work? That's sort of the same thing. How do we use it? And isn't turpentine paint thinner? So what the hell are you putting? Why don't you put it on your whatever? Let's hear about turpentine. And
yeah,
welcome.
So it definitely is paint thinner. And in my opinion, that's actually what makes it effective. But, you know, it's not a petroleum product. It's not from the chemical industry. This is something that has been harvested from nature for, you know, at least centuries in different continents and in different cultures. And it's made from the sap of the pine tree. And what they do to harvest it is they actually, and different varieties of pine, even larch can be used. So a variety of conifers to make turpentine, although they all have a slightly different composition. But if we go to like the old farmers in Georgia, in, you know, the early history of the United States, what they would do is strip the bark off the pine trees and cut away a little bit of the surface layer of the wood. And then they would install these metal ramps that collected the sap as it oozed out and then directed it down into a collection vessel like a bucket or a trough. You know, everybody had their own little setup, and they would collect this sap, which they called the gum, because it is like this kind of off-white, gummy, gelatinous substance. And you could imagine that it must contain a bit of structured water in there.
Yeah.
And then they take that gum and distill it once they have big enough quantities. They add water to it and then heat it up until the oil fraction evaporates. And then they, you know, run that through a condenser and collect it, and that is the gum spirits of turpentine, or the actual turpentine. And then eventually, then they boil off the water fraction, and they're left with a semi-solid material, which is the pine tar. And that has other applications, right? Like you probably remember the pitchers on the mound with the pine tar rosin, right? So,
And pine tar has been used medically. I remember it as treatment for psoriasis or something.
yeah, absolutely. And there are other products that could be made from pine sap and pine resin as well. And some of them are used in different liniments and other kinds of applications in different cultures.
So, in some ways, it sounds a bit like maple sap, like the way we get maple syrup from, but not really. You're not collecting the running fluid of a tree. It's
Well,
more
no,
like.
it is the running fluid. It just doesn't, and you just tap it in a different way,
Tap it in a
right?
different way.
But it is very similar. Obviously the maple sap contains different things, right? Because it has a lot of sugar. And that you don't distill, you just concentrate it by boiling off the water, right? And making it a thicker syrup for our culinary taste profiles. So, but in the sense that you're taking the sap of a tree and just essentially processing it by applying heat, it's very, very similar in what you're doing. And it's important to just recognize that it's a natural substance, right? There, you don't have to do any synthetic chemistry to make turpentine.
See, and there's nothing added to it. There's things taken away from it, essentially, except
Well,
water,
it
basically.
depends on where you're buying it. So, in some places where they sell it as paint thinner, like hardware stores or art supply stores, they may actually denature it with other things that I would say are contaminants. Right? They could add benzene, for example, to it. But no, it is basically a natural product. It can be, further processed and things can be taken out of it. The two main it's essentially a mixture of terpenes, which are a class of chemicals that are botanical and associated with trees, but also many other plants. And the two most predominant are alpha and beta pinene, and they make up about 75% of the constituents. And then there are four or five other constituents in smaller amounts, like limonene is one of them. And many other, botanicals have some of these same terpenes in different amounts as well.
So I wasn't clear. So is this a fat soluble fraction or water soluble fraction?
Yeah, this is the oil fraction of
The
the
oil
sap.
fraction.
And that's really key to how it works, but it's not, and that's why it's such a good paint thinner. For people who use oil paints, those can be very, very hard to dissolve. And turpentine just does it really, really well.
Got it. So turpentine is the fat. Again, correct me if I'm wrong. The fat soluble fraction of the pine resin,
The pine sap, yes.
pine sap. Got it. And the water part has been essentially evaporated off.
Yeah, it's separated during the distillation process. I
Got it.
believe the oil fraction actually has a lower boiling point, so it comes off first.
Got it. All right. So why is the fat soluble fraction of the pine resin, what does it do in a living system like us? And why, let's correlate that with why people get sick or how people get sick.
Yeah, well, definitely, those are two important aspects to commingle. Let me first just
Or
say
yeah, back up a little. Yeah,
a
go
little
ahead.
bit about what turpentine does and how it interacts with your body. So it can be taken many different ways. It's readily absorbed into the body, and it can be through the skin. It's readily absorbed by inhalation. And also can be taken orally. And because of its fatty nature, right, being able to dissolve all fatty things, it can easily penetrate into the body, into the fatty tissue, and across the cell membrane lipids, whether they're membranes or not. It can definitely dissolve those and intermingle. So it spreads widely through the body. And there is a pharmacokinetic study in rats that shows pretty wide distribution in several organs and especially in the adipose tissue and any, visceral fat around the organs or any fatty areas of the body and especially into the brain where there's a high fat content. Now, to
So
talk about.
let me just stop there, just to so we get. So in other words, it's I'd say reasonably proven that the first question of any medicine, any therapeutic substance is, does it actually get into us? And that seems to have been confirmed because of the nature of turpentine. It shows up in various tissues of our body.
It readily distributes throughout the body, and
Got it.
that's been demonstrated. Absolutely.
Right. So
Now,
that's an important step.
that's right. Now, there's two ways that it can help your body heal. One of those is as an antioxidant, and I'll talk about that separately, but the main reason is because of the solvent properties. Now, just to kind of review a little bit about what solubility is that different substances are said to have different polarity. In other words, within the substance is the charge of it, right? Because all substances have charge. Is it evenly distributed in the molecule? And like turpentine, where that would be considered nonpolar, right? Because there's no pole that's more positive and more negative, versus polar molecules, where there is sort of a charge separation, and one part of the molecule has more of a negative charge, and another part of it has more of a positive charge. And that would be like water. And polar substances tend to dissolve in water. But there, of course, is a spectrum. It's not like polar or nonpolar.
Right.
And the things that are way at the nonpolar end that won't come near water dissolve readily in turpentine. And why is that important? And this is because I've been really looking into toxins that are, and specifically, I wanted to actually find research, and I have found quite a bit of it, where they examine the tissues of humans and to see if environmental toxins are present. And this has been done to a degree, and there are some types of toxins that are virtually found in every single individual. And these are known as persistent organic pollutants. So these are different classes of substances. Some of them have been banned for decades, but they're still found in everybody's body, even though they've been completely banned from being used. And I'm talking about things like DDT, the
Yeah.
famous insecticide, and its relative DDE. Also, PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, dioxin, and there are many different dioxin compounds, as well as the so-called forever chemicals, the perfluoroalkyl substances that are used in, non-stick and water-repellent textiles, etc. So these are all fat-soluble compounds, and what happens in the body is that they tend to accumulate in fatty tissues. Now, the liver can metabolize these to some degree and make them water-soluble and excrete them, but many of them don't ever make it to the liver. They go right into the fatty tissue, predominantly the adipose tissue, but also in other fatty areas of the body, like in the fat around the organs, for example. They also can penetrate the muscle. You know how a good quality steak, right, is determined by the amount of marbling, right, which is the
Right.
fat that's actually in the muscle. Now, that's not really good for the animal. And it's not really good for us. So if we, are lean and healthy, we don't have that kind of fat inside the muscle, but if we get into metabolic issues and obesity, we can actually have fat marbling in our muscles, and that will be a site that would attract these chemicals to be stored there. And of course, that can lead to various types of muscle-related issues. Also, these chemicals tend to go into the brain, more so than other things because of the fat solubility. And there have been many studies looking at the toxicity of these substances, and it's considerable, and which is why many of these things were taken off the market. So now, in addition to these persistent organic pollutants, there are many other fat-soluble toxins that we're exposed to. And some of these are plastic-related or plasticizing chemicals like phthalates, but also pharmaceuticals. It turns out that a major challenge for pharmaceutical manufacturers is that most of the drug candidates are fat-soluble only. And this makes them challenging to work in the water environment of the biological organism. So they have to tweak them to change their pharmaceutical properties. And then we also have seed oils. And there's been some quite interesting research. Now, one of the issues with seed oils that we know about is that they are readily oxidized, and then they become oxidants themselves when they're in our body. And plant sterols, which are a component of the seed oils, and those are like the compounds that are chemically related to cholesterol, but they don't function as cholesterol in our bodies. They've actually now been found in the aortic cusps of an individual with aortic stenosis.
Wow.
And there's additional data implicating them in cardiovascular and metabolic disease. So we've kind of got an assault of many of these chemicals from multiple sources, in the food supply, obviously, and plus ingredients that really aren't food,
Right.
and other environmental exposures. And also, many of us were born with some of these chemicals in our body. Like PCBs were taken off the market, I believe, in 1979, but in somewhere around 2010, they're still found in people, and they're said to have a half-life of 29 years. So, if you were born with 100 milligrams in your body, right, by the time you're 30, there's going to be now 50
50.
milligrams.
Yeah. So, and again, correct me if I got this wrong, but my understanding is we do have a way of processing, metabolizing, and getting rid of excreting these fat-soluble toxins. But interestingly, it's a process called conjugation in the liver, which converts fat-soluble toxins into water-soluble compounds, which then can be excreted. But I think what the point here is, first of all, it has to get to the liver. And second of all, there's probably a limit to how much the liver can process and make fat soluble.
Yeah, there's a number of challenges here, Tom. One thing is that many of these substances can be toxic to the liver itself, so they can
Yeah, right.
disrupt, right, the liver's ability in that way. Now, it's more than just conjugation because you have the cytochrome P450 enzyme system that first acts on many of these compounds, especially pharmaceuticals and synthetic organic compounds. And so there could be several biotransformations that are attempted by the liver before it becomes water soluble if it's successful. But what happens is some of these compounds are not transformed at all by the liver enzymes, and some of them get broken down into a metabolite that is also lipophilic, right? Not water soluble. And so there can be like an arresting of the detox pathways. Now, fortunately, it's been shown that even if they remain lipophilic, there are still two ways they could be excreted by the body. So one is through the bile. So the liver would not be able to make it water soluble, would put it, into the bile system, and the gallbladder will dump it in the bowels where it'll end up in the toilet. There's also a non-biliary route where directly through the blood, it can get to the colon to be eliminated. It's just that most of it is bound up, in the fatty tissues. So it can't make it to the liver and undergo this. However, there are several procedures that have been identified that can increase the excretion pathways, and mostly they involve losing weight and breaking down the fatty tissue or
Right.
lipolysis.
Yeah, got it. So I think to summarize that, there's a pretty good case that Living beings, including humans, have been inundated with lipophilic, i.e., fat-soluble chemicals, which are toxic to our basic metabolic function, which we have not been able to excrete, and therefore, at least there's a good reason to think they may be causing us problems, and that may be a huge understatement.
Yeah, I agree. And also it's not just metabolic issues because many of these substances are toxic to a variety of parts of our body, like organochlorine pesticides, for example, are very neurologically toxic. And just backing up for one second and think about, right, there are water-soluble toxins, and our body is it can experience toxicity from that, but it's able to eliminate and get rid of these toxins. So if we have a health problem from a water-soluble toxin, if we stop exposing ourselves to that particular problematic source, then the body should be able to resolve it within a matter of a relatively short amount of time. But with these lipophilic substances that accumulate in our tissues, our body can't readily just get rid of them. They can persist for decades and decades, as we talked about. So, we need to somehow stimulate the body to be able to dump these things. And there are many strategies that could be used, of course, although turpentine seems to be quite effective.
And so again, I'm speculating, and so correct me if I'm wrong, but you could, at least now we have a sort of a hypothesis that if you have muscle dysfunction and you've got fat embedded in your muscle because of whatever reason, and you've got toxins in that fat, that could lead to muscle dysfunction. If
Absolutely.
you've got a pancreas that has fat around it, which we know it does, and the fat around the pancreas has these fat-soluble toxins in it, which we seem to know now that it does, that could be a reason for, functional pancreatic insufficiency or malfunction, otherwise known as diabetes or pancreatic, and on and on and on. So whatever organ, which means every organ, has fat around it or fat in it or just being fat, then you are going to increase your exposure to these poisons, creating dysfunction and erroneously called disease.
Right. Now, Tom, let's also not forget those thin people that can eat any kind of junk food they want and never gain weight, because those people develop a lot of fat around their organs in their abdominal cavity. And that is another place that can store a lot of these. So if you're thin, you're not necessarily out of the woods. It really depends on your lifestyle.
It's an interesting thing to think about because, again, if we, as I tend to come from the idea that your body has fat around the organs, that's probably not a bad idea. To give it a, like a reserve of energy, not a lot, but a little bit. So you have a cushion and a reserve of energy, but the problem is if it's full of PCBs and dioxin, then it becomes that strategy backfires on you.
Yeah, exactly. And this could just be an amount because we all have some visceral fat. We need that for the sort of functions that you described, and as insulation as well, cushioning, many things. But it's when it becomes excessive, right? And we know this is related to our endocrine regulation, of metabolism, like with things like insulin sensitivity being reduced.
And excessive and poisoned.
Yeah, of course. And we're all poisoned to some degree because the way these things get into us is it's just they're everywhere.
Right.
right? And so once we become aware of it, we can certainly mitigate it quite substantially, but we're not going to completely eliminate it.
Got it. So that's a, I think, a pretty coherent and clear case that we have a problem with fat-soluble toxins in our bodies, right? So that's step one. All right. So turpentine, where does that, are we there yet to?
Yeah, certainly. Well, so really the simple thing is that turpentine dissolves all of these substances and helps them get out of the body. So when there have been several strategies that have been looked at of how you can increase excretion of these substances and decrease the body burden. And one of the strategies was actually to give a lipophile, as they call it, something like turpentine. To see if that does it. And now, of course, they're going to use artificial or man-made preparations. So they've used things like, I believe, hexadecaine
Yeah.
and squalene, and also olestra, the drug that prevents fat absorption. And they said that, these things didn't get absorbed into the body. They were just going to sequester these toxins in the gut. But interestingly, they actually found them in the organs of the body. So they did get absorbed, like turpentine does. But with the use of these substances, it did increase excretion substantially. Now, there was also a trial done with an Ayurvedic protocol, where they did some general detoxing, like with some herbal laxatives and enemas. They did a low-fat, high-fiber diet, but they used a lipophile, which was clarified butter. And so they drank clarified butter every day. And at the end of only 2 weeks, they had significantly lower levels of many of these pollutants. Now, not all of them were excreted as much as the ones that were, mitigated the most, but they all went down.
Wow.
So there's been really, good evidence that using an oily solvent can really be successful with this
You know, I
issue.
just recently heard from a vet that I know that you, if you take a dog that has been poisoned with a known fat-soluble toxin and give it what they call IV lipids, and she didn't exactly know what was in there, but that you can dramatic like save the dog. Dog will
That's right.
die. Yeah.
It's the same principle, and they're using probably linoleic acid
Yeah.
in that, the toxic seed oil oxidized lipid. But still, the toxicity of that is nowhere, near what it is of many of these other things.
Right.
And anecdotally, I did have an associate that I was speaking with who developed ivermectin toxicity. And which was actually quite significant neurologic toxicity, and it was the classic textbook type of problems. And that is also a fat-soluble toxin. So this individual used turpentine for a few days and was able to alleviate all the toxic symptoms.
So essentially, what we're saying is these fats get these toxins that are fat soluble get embedded in the tissues. They're hard to get out, and you need to dissolve the fat with another fat, essentially.
Yeah, that's one very, very successful strategy. Fasting was also looked at, or they call it, a starvation diet in animal studies. And the toxins did release because the fat tissue broke down. But what happened in that case is that it was overwhelmed, probably the liver, and many of the toxins translocated to other organs, like the brain, the heart, etc. So this was, I think one of the things is that using this strategy with a solvent is that it does it in a gradual way, not acutely dumping all these things and overwhelming your system.
Got it.
So that's one of the advantages of, I think, why this strategy is so successful.
And so is there a particular like unique composition of turpentine that makes it particularly suited for this purpose?
Well, that has not been studied really, but there are several clinical studies of turpentine, some of them topical, some internal, and some with baths. And they do use different preparations. Like, for example, there's a study on about 30 individuals with COPD. And in that study, they used a bathtub of turpentine. Now, this was a Russian study, and I could not get the manuscript, so I only had the abstract. And I'm not sure, you know, how much turpentine they put in that bathtub. But those patients, and they use larch turpentine, so I'm sure that that has some different terpenes composition. And but those patients had substantial improvement, and I think most notably is that their pulmonary hypertension decreased. And you know, we know from allopathic medicine that when there's pulmonary hypertension, there's really nothing that could be done. It's just a progressive factor that it means your lungs are going in the wrong direction.
All right. So, do you want to get into a little bit then how, like, what maybe what you've seen or what people have reported or any studies on how it works, and then a little bit about how to use it, like what situation you would do it in besides being a actually like a living person? That may be the only criteria there is.
Yeah,
Like
well,
if you're alive, like if you're dead, don't do it.
there are
'Cause it
very
won't.
few contraindications. So there's not much out there about how it works, except for one study where it's looking at turpentine as an antioxidant. And this was quite impressive, actually. So one thing they did is they looked at the interaction. They added turpentine to a lipid peroxidation reaction involving the seed oil constituent linoleic acid, and found that it substantially inhibited lipid peroxidation. And this is really important because oxidized lipids is one of the things that we find in lots of disease, especially cardiovascular disease. Now, it also was tested for other antioxidant properties like superoxide scavenger, a free radical scavenger, and it scored really high. In fact, it exceeded vitamin E's antioxidant capabilities. And, you know, vitamin E is commonly used actually as a preservative in various foods and beauty products. So that's pretty impressive, in my opinion. But most of the studies were quite interesting because it's used in animal studies to supposedly induce inflammation. But in some of these studies, there were quite surprising findings. So there was one study where they used it, and they injected it, by the way, subcutaneously in this study.
And when you say it, you mean turpentine.
Yes, turpentine. They injected turpentine into these apolipoprotein E deficient mice. So these are genetically modified, you know, mice used for studies that develop lots of atherosclerotic lesions. And they had a control group. This was a controlled trial. And in the group that they gave the turpentine to, they had substantially smaller plaque lesions. And that was, you know, they weren't even expecting that finding, but they reported on it because it was quite significant statistically. So, you know, that's quite an interesting finding. Now, there are many other surprising findings that kind of show that turpentine can help in almost any situation. So, another experiment, they were experimenting with lethal radiation. I'm talking about ionizing radiation. And they gave rats a dose of radiation that would be expected to kill half of them. And they were using other substances that are known to protect from radiation poisoning. But they also added turpentine to the mix. They combined it with other things and gave it alone. And I think they just gave one dose before the radiation treatment. And it Only 10% of the animals with turpentine died, whereas 50% of them died when they didn't get turpentine. So this, you know, I don't know how to explain the effectiveness of this other than possibly, at least in part, through the antioxidant properties, but it was quite amazing. Now, there also were several studies showing that turpentine as a pre-medication can mitigate the toxicity of other substances. And this included some pretty nasty things like parathion, an insecticide that's been taken off the market, and also 6-mercaptopurine, which is an anti-metabolite chemotherapy drug, and carrageenan. So, you know, quite interesting that it prevented the toxicity. Now, in terms of, you know, treatment.
That's like saying the mechanism of injury, this goes back to Florence Nightingale, is decay. And that maybe the biochemical mechanism of decay is this sort of oxidative damage. So we may not know the way it works, but it seems to protect the tissues against this kind of oxidative damage.
Yes, absolutely. And I, you know, when I think of that, I kind of just think about a rusty old car.
Yeah.
That, you know, when these things get in your body, everything they touch just kind of turns to rust. And, you know, that when it's rusty, it doesn't work as well.
Right. And it's even the structure decays. So, you know, you get cars and that it actually eats away at the integrity of the tissue.
That's right. And that's why, you know, you see microorganisms being recruited to that part of your body because they are eating up the decayed you know, bits of tissue so that they don't fester and cause other problems.
Right. Got it. Okay.
So you're right to say that there's almost no contraindications for turpentine. The only time I would say not to use it is when you're pregnant or nursing. And the reason, you know, is for pregnancy, one is it can actually induce contractions or labor. So you don't want that until the right time. And then also the dose that would be appropriate for the mother is not the dose that would be appropriate for the growing fetus. So there could be, you know, everything depending on the amount is toxic. So you don't want to overdo it, including with turpentine or, you know, even you can overdo it even with water, as you know.
Yeah.
So, and then with lactating mothers, one thing is, and I didn't mention that the body has another way of excreting these fat-soluble toxins, and it's in the breast milk.
Right.
And they've been found in the breast milk in much higher quantities than the blood. So it seems that the woman's body would concentrate it there. So in addition, you don't want, you know, turpentine to be in the breast milk, but even more so, you don't want a bunch of these toxins that are being dumped to be in there. So you know, would just either, the best thing is to do this before you get pregnant. But if you already are in that stage, wait till your child is finished nursing, and then it'd be a great time to do the turpentine protocol yourself. But other than that, really, it's amazing the variety of conditions that have been reported in the literature and then in my anecdotal experience where turpentine has produced amazing results.
Yeah, I think I've heard you say, and again, I don't want to get anything wrong here, but you've actually seen people with like clinical documented diabetes. And, you know, we all know they should stop eating sugar and do a little more exercise and all that stuff. But I think you've actually been able to help them with turpentine as well. Can you say anything about that?
Yeah, well, let's just focus on the type 2 diabetes first. So many people, just by changing their diet and cutting out, you know, sugar and carbs, can get back to normal blood sugar regulation. But if they go back to, you know, off their diet, they can easily go back to diabetes. And then some people, with even their best effort with diet, they're not able to completely shake it. So for those folks, I think it's really some fat-soluble toxins that are just disrupting their insulin physiology. And by changing the diet alone, they can't fully get those things out of the body. So, but I've had many clients who use the turpentine protocol in this situation, and in 3 weeks, everyone's blood sugar is totally normal.
Wow.
And it's very important to, you know, hold off on the blood sugar lowering medications if you're going to do this, because it's much more dangerous to have your blood sugar too low. Now, even people with type 1 diabetes have had an amazing reductions in their insulin requirement. One client from 40 somewhat units a day to 2 units a day. And that's just in 4 weeks. So if they had, continued to work on it, I wonder, the possibility of completely reversing type 1 is certainly there.
And do you want to say anything about, so there could be, the categories could be sort of well people age 35 to 60, maybe sort of well people over 60, people with sort of not so serious, not serious, but like diabetes, chronic disease. And then there's the category of acute illness. Like, do you want to break it down into those, like what, how people could do it?
Yeah,
Just
absolutely.
briefly.
Well, so first of all, and what I, in my consultation practice and what I really focus on is serious and life-threatening illness. So, autoimmune disease, metabolic disease like cardiovascular disease and strokes, cancer, all of these conditions can respond very, very well to turpentine. Now, as we get, some people can do this just for a general cleansing protocol, right? That they're in pretty good health, but they want to tune up or they want to take sort of preventative action. And you will notice that many little things will clear up when you do this, like things that we might even attribute to aging. Now, also, this is very safe for children. So there are many, now I wouldn't do it just for fun with kids, but if the child has a health issue, I have many success stories for different things, including serious infections, but also malabsorption syndrome and neurologic or neurodevelopmental disorders, like autism and Tourette's and things like that. So, it can be used safely. Obviously, there'd be some different procedures and a lower dose that you would follow. But all of that is, I'm really, we're talking about, doing a full protocol, which has several other aspects to make it safe and make it effective. And but that's with taking the turpentine internally. But it can be used for many acute conditions and other conditions in other ways, like topically is how I first experimented with it, and there are actually two published randomized controlled trials for skin infections, one for folliculitis and one for skin abscesses. And what I used it for was cellulitis. I used to get a recurrent cellulitis before I got wise to natural healing. And when I first just put a couple of drops on a skin infection, I did that 3 times in 1 day, and the next morning it was totally cleared up. All the other times I just used bacitracin ointment, and it took about 2 weeks to clear up. I'm not sure if the bacitracin did anything or not, but I knew that I didn't want to take oral antibiotics even back then when I wasn't completely awake. And then when I did the internal protocol, since that time I never had another skin infection. So I've also found it to be extremely effective for wound infections, and actually historically it was used by many surgeons for bad wound infections, contaminated wounds, and also to stop bleeding as a hemostatic agent. And there were some surgeons that were very strong advocates that you could read about in some historical papers from the 1800s. In that respect. And then there's the inhaled use of the turpentine. And this comes in really handy for acute respiratory illnesses, but also for asthma attacks. And also, it would be part of the way I would approach treatment for chronic lung diseases like COPD and even interstitial lung disease can benefit from turpentine, where there's really no treatment in conventional medicine. And you just put some drops on top of a pot of boiling water and do a steam inhalation, or you could use a nebulizer to inhale it, and that can be very effective for bronchitis, pneumonia, even croup. I mean, that I have a 1-year-old at home, And over the summer, after we got all of the, Canadian wildfire smoke, whatever that stuff was, everyone in my family got a respiratory illness, and my son got like a croup with the airway strider, and we eventually did the inhalation with him, and he was like 6 months at the time, and within minutes, he stopped making those sounds, and then he was fully recovered the next day. So, it's really quite amazing, used in a variety of ways.
My guess is that there's probably two components to that. One is some of the pathology is from actual, like, so-called oxidative damage to the tissues, which is then creating irritation and maybe spasm. And so it has a direct effect on that, like immediate. And the second is it's this decaying of the tissue, which it helps, that's the more the toxic issue, and it gets rid of the toxin so the tissue doesn't decay, and so that cycle is probably broken.
I think these are interconnected because what's causing the oxidative damage, right, is the toxins that are at the location of the problem. And then so it's exerting the antioxidant influence, but then also kind of washing them away. I mean, think about how we use solvents in our house, right? Those are the cleaners, essentially, right? When we make up a vinegar solution or use a poison industrial cleaner, it's essentially dissolving whatever the dirt and muck is that we're trying to clean. And so you could think about it as it's going around and kind of, like with a mop full of turpentine in your lungs.
Dissolving the muck in your body. That's, we study for 20 years and it all comes down to you got muck in your body and you got to get rid of it. And you think, all these years, I've been studying this pathway and this, and doesn't mean a whole lot, probably. All
Yeah, well,
right.
if
Go
it made
ahead.
it into the mainstream, they'd make up all sorts of molecular pathways about it. Even some of the studies are already like that.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, so you did a workshop on this that people can access to get like exact protocol doses, how do you do it, all that. Can you tell people where to find that?
Yeah, so and I'll provide you the link that we can put below here. It's called the Power of Pine Workshop, and it was just last evening on Easter Sunday, and I went through all of the scientific arguments why to use turpentine and presented a lot of data about turpentine, including its safety. And you may not even realize it's used in many food products in small quantities. And it's the FDA allows that readily.
And Vicks VapoRub was
Yeah, Vicks VapoRub as well, of course, and some other products. I found some Chinese ointments that contain it as well. So I go through all that, and then I step by step go through the protocol, which is a very detailed protocol based on many years of my experience. And the protocol is included, of course, with the workshop as well as the slides. And several other bonuses. And this is, a lifetime replay. So, because you might want to watch certain aspects of it a few times to make sure that you have all the details correct and you can do this, in a safe and effective way. So, that is still available, of course. And then, in addition to that, in my True Living Fellowship platform, we're actually doing a detox challenge where I think there might be already a couple of hundred people signed up for this, that we're all gonna do this protocol together, including myself. I'm gonna do a few extra things actually myself with it, and I'm gonna give a couple of webinars to answer questions and help people get through it, and I'm gonna post about my own experience as I go through it myself and let you know how that's proceeding. Because I'm going to try to get rid of my eyeglasses during this detox.
Great. All right. And so we'll put the links to that, and everybody can sign up and check that out. And it's really great that you're doing this, Andy. I mean, I think we do need to move from Be like, yeah, there's no viruses and all that, but eventually we have to start. Here are strategies that actually work to get us healthier than we used to be, and I think that's where we're heading now.
Well, of course, once you realize that germs are not our enemy or causing any problems, the curiosity leads to, well, what is it exactly? And then, how can we rectify it? And, the overarching principle for me is that the answers are in nature.
Answers in nature, and maybe and working with how your body would like to do it, but maybe needs a little help. The
That's right.
body is trying to detox, but it just doesn't, it wasn't used to the amount, the capacity that it has to deal with these days.
That's right. And even with turpentine, the body is what's taking all the action, right? The turpentine may dissolve these things, but if your body can't get rid of them, you're not going to get better.
Got it. All right, Andy, any final words?
Well, just really enjoy catching up with you, Tom, and it's definitely nice to be among friends.
Got it. I can't say enough about that either. So thanks for being there and all the work that you're doing. We'll put the links in. Everybody check it out. And thanks everybody for joining us.